Today's Taisho will be on Case 46 in the Mumonkand, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 46 is entitled, Proceed On from the Top of the Pole. Sekiso Osho asked, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, you, who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole, and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. Mumon's comment, if you go on further and turn your body about, no place is left where you are not the master. But even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of a 100-foot pole, eh? Mumon's verse, he darkens the third eye of insight and clings to the first mark on the scale. Even though he may sacrifice his life, he is only a blind man leading the blind. Today is the fourth day of our winter sesshin. I'm very glad that so many people arrived last night. I'm so glad to see all of you. It's really wonderful. There are people here with whom I have been practicing Zen for 16 years. And that's just thrilling. It's deeply moving, you know, to see friends, people I love very much, and to walk this beautiful path together. It's just really amazing. I'm so glad you could be here. And there are people who are here for their first time, and I'm so glad you came. I hope you plumb the depths of this amazing Zen. If this is the first time you came here, if you practice with your whole heart, if you try to be open-hearted about it, I think this can be a life-transforming experience. I'm not trying to sell you on something, you know. I just think I've been doing Zen for 35 years, something like that, 34 years. And I still enjoy it quite a bit. You know, get up every day and sit, and I love it, and I'm happy. You know, it really helps. It's quite amazing. People come into Dokusan and talk about their opening up to the world, and it's just wonderful. You see it again and again and again. So to old friends and new friends, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. I think that one way of understanding Zen is to realize that it really and truly is a path of liberation. And in Buddhism, you know, we often think of liberation as having very much to do with the way we look at things, the Buddha said, you are as you think. This is one of his earliest teachings. The Buddha lived in a world that was highly magical. Magical world, very religious culture. And there were gods all over the place. In India, if you throw a rock, you'll hit a god, you know. And there are countless rituals and temples and so on. And it's quite beautiful, really quite beautiful. And so, you know, basically, if you want to be successful in business, you can get a Lakshmi statue and put it in your office. And if you want to be successful in love, you can do this, and so on and so on. And the Buddha said, you know, actually, I'm not really interested in any of that. You know, actually, the key to all of this is your own mental world. You know, so he really shifted things very dramatically. You know, he said, look, you know, you can get a Lakshmi statue, but really, you need to look at the way you're imagining the world, the way you're thinking about things. If you really want to change, if you want success, get a Lakshmi statue. If you want to change the world you live in, you need to change the way you think about things. You know, many years ago, a couple of women came into to the Zen Center and told me about their new store, and they had built this. They had created this business, and it was just opening up, and they were very nervous about its potential failure. And the woman, who was an American woman, said, you know, will Zen help me to be successful in my business? And she had come for a sit, and she had sat, and after the sit, I said, how was your meditation? And she said, it was okay. But what I really wanted to know is I've got a business, and I want to know, will Zen help me to be successful in my business? And I said, Zen will help you to be happy whether your business is successful or not. And then I turned and said something to somebody else, and I turned back and she was gone. Really, it was like that. It was like, wow, that was fast. Yeah. I'm very sensitive to the difficulties of people in business. You know, if you are an English teacher, you have tenure, you know. So unless the state of New Jersey goes bankrupt, and that could never happen, right? I'm safe, right? You know, it would be on. You know, probably could go bankrupt. You know, it's a good deal. You know, so I understand that I'm sitting in a very comfortable place. And my brother, you know, was a businessman, and he was agonized all the time. You know. My brother really worked very hard, and he was really constantly struggling. He was a biology major, and he decided not to go to graduate school. Instead, he went into the import. He got into the import business, working for a very nice Syrian man named Joseph Shaya. And eventually my brother was able to work his way up and actually buy the business from Mr. Shaya. And my brother owned a Middle Eastern carpet import business. Nobody's going to buy Middle Eastern carpets from a guy named Spellmeyer, so he kept the name Shaya, the Shaya brothers. But my brother built this business up and really... was a serious businessman, you know. But he would have these terrible days, you know, like he'd get a shipment of rugs in, and, you know, he would go to Syria or he would go to India and buy rugs. And then he'd get the bill of, you know, the bill of the shipping report, and he'd read it, and some of the rugs he paid for weren't there. And then, you know, he'd call somebody up, and that guy would, well, put him on the boat or put them on a train, you know, put them on the, and it's like, come on, you know, where are my rugs? And so then he'd have to take people to court and, you know, this sort of thing. And you know, you would think, well, he's right, surely he'll win if it goes to court. But, you know, it's not, he would not always win, you know. And so he had, you know, he would have many days where he would come home and, you know, be agonized at the end of the day. You know, maybe he had been ripped off, and then he'd gone to court, and he hadn't recovered the money, And I, after my brother's death, you know, I talked to some of the people who worked for him, and they really, they didn't have to be nice, but they really thought he was a good guy, you know. So anyway, I really understand that it's hard to be, you know, a business person where one day, you know, you can be riding high and the next day you can be broke, you know. You know, life has, you know, these, you know, there's this kind of uncertainty to life. And so I wasn't being flippant when I said to this woman, you know, the important thing is to try to be happy whether you're successful at this game or not, you know. She really wanted me to promise her that Zen would make her as successful. And I that wouldn't be truthful, but it's not necessarily the best thing for her, you know. I mean, I don't know what's good for her, but, you know, sometimes we have goals. We set goals for ourselves that aren't really the goals we want to pursue, you know. Or maybe another way to put it is we have goals that don't really express what's best for ourselves, you know. I have a friend of mine who is, now let me just say, I know a number of people who are doctors, and you know, some of them love their work. My own doctor is really a wonderful man, Dr. Gandotra. Not put that in the tape. I'm not supposed to use real names. I'm sorry. But he's a wonderful man. Earlier I was telling everybody that I got really sick just before Sesshin, and I went to the doctor, my doctor. And I said, basically I was hinting that I had already diagnosed myself. Basically I said, I had the flu, and I have a bacterial infection, and I would like antibiotics. I didn't really say that to my doctor, but I hoped that he was going to give me antibiotics. So I went in to see him, and he looked at me, and I made my puppy dog eyes, like, oh, I'm so sick, doctor, you know, you can guess it, oh, yes, you know. And anyway, I was definitely, you know, really showing him how unhappy I was, hoping he would go, oh, this looks like a bacteria, I'll write you an antibiotic. You know, because that would be so... And he looked me over and he listened and he said, yes, you have the flu. He said, you know, you'll be okay. You can go back to work on Friday if you want. So I didn't tell him about Sesshin. And he wrote me Tamiflu. He's such a good guy. You know, he's doing the right thing, right? You know, people go to their doctors and ask for antibiotics, and he refused. I mean, he's politely refused to do this before, you know, when I've been more direct, you know. He's just said, you know, I'm sure you'll be okay, you know. And that's like a good doctor, you know. And he loves his work. It's so clear. He's really like, he knows, he's very up on everything, you know. And by the way, he recently had cancer himself. About 7 months ago, I went in to see him for something else, and I noticed that he had lost all his hair, which is growing back now. And so he has a medical practice, and he was struggling with chemotherapy. And of course, you know, if you're a doctor, I think he has his own practice, right? So, I mean, basically, he's like an independent businessman. And so he can't say, okay, I'm going to close my business down while I go get chemotherapy. He has to keep the business going, and he has to get the chemotherapy. And, you know, when I went in to see him, his hair was gone, and he was right there, right on top of the details. And so he was struggling with chemo and being his usual excellent self. So it's really inspiring to me. He's somebody whose inner life matches his outer life, you know. It's like the inner, the unconscious satya matches the public satya, you know. And so, I don't know. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I just get the feeling this is a guy who loves what he does. And, you know, I think he gets up in the morning and thinks, I'm on, you know, he's thinking medicine, you know, and he wants to be a healer. And he clearly enjoys it. And he's always happy to, he's generally pretty happy to see me because I'm in pretty good shape, you know. And he always, you know, tells me I can gain a few pounds and, you know, maybe he's just buttering me up. But he always says, you know, if only all my patients were, he's a vegetarian too. And he says, if only all my patients were vegetarians like you, you know, I'd have fewer patients, you know. And then he says, and you can gain a few pounds, you know. And so, anyway, he's a great man. But, you know, I have a, and that's a good life. I mean, when the inner and the outer match up, that's really like the ideal thing, right? It's not always possible, you know, but when the inner and the outer match up, you know, that's wonderful. Sometimes, though, the inner and the outer don't match up exactly right. So I have a friend who's also a doctor, you know, or he's on the way to becoming a doctor. And, you know, basically, he too is like Asian. And so basically, parental decisions are hugely important. Basically this guy became a doctor because his parents ordered him to become a doctor. And he's, you know, he's getting through it all, but he doesn't necessarily want to be a doctor, you know. Now, it doesn't mean he doesn't, I'm not sure he doesn't want to be a doctor, but he didn't have a free choice, you know. It was kind of like, you know, when he was about 10, people began to say, well, doctor, you know, what field of medicine are you going into, you know, and things like that. And I think, you know, you're a kid, you don't know what you want to do, right, you know. So I think that basically he suddenly woke up one day and found himself in medical school. And, you know, the outer and the inner didn't match up. You know, the deep, the unconscious and the public didn't match up, you know. So this can create a lot of tension, you know, a lot of tension. And can make us very unhappy. Because, you know, we want to be good children. You know, we want to be good boys and girls. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. People who love us and care about us, you know, have imagined that we would be happy in such and such a life. And so, you know, we pursue that dream. And yet maybe inside of ourselves there's something saying to us, this is not really what I want, you know. And this can create a huge amount of tension and pressure, right? You know, often I think it's quite interesting that we don't necessarily trust ourselves. You know, we don't trust ourselves very often. And we frighten ourselves a little bit sometimes, right? Because, it's a little bit scary to, you know, to try to know yourself. You know, Zen, I think, is all about trying to know yourself, you know. Even though Zen is about forgetting the self, it also requires knowing the self, you know. So, I mean, Zen is not just about coming in, sitting on the cushion, going into Mushin, and encountering bliss, right? That's not Zen. It can be like that. You know, you come in, you sit down on the cushion, and you go into deep Mushin, and you have this wonderful ecstatic experience. But more often what happens is you sit down on the cushion, you're in Mushin for a little while, and then you begin to think about something that's troubling you, right? And you could say, this is a distraction from my real work, which is Mu, or my koan. Why am I wasting my time with this unimportant detail, you know? But maybe, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, and all the time you're on the cushion, you're thinking about something that's bothering you a lot, you know? Maybe something at work or something in your personal life. And very often, you know, people will come into Dokusan and I'll say, what's happening with your koan? They'll go, nothing. And I'll say, well, are you focusing on it? And, well, I'm trying to focus. And I'll say, well, what's going on? And they'll say, well, I keep thinking about things. They're not important. And I'll say, well, tell me about it. And they might say, well, I think I might be headed for divorce, you know. I say, well, that sounds important, you know. So it might not be that dramatic, you know. It might just be I'm worried about my job, or I'm not really happy. And, you know, it takes actually a lot of it takes a lot of courage just to say sometime, I'm not really happy, you know. I mean, you know, I read in the paper about this French, he's from France, and he studied in the Tibetan tradition. His name is Ricard. And I can't remember his first name right now, but Mathieu Ricard. And Mathieu Ricard, he's actually, when he's interviewed, you know, like on TV, there'll be a little thing that comes on under his head, you know, and it says, happiest man in the world. You know, so Mathieu, they say, and now we have a Tibetan monk, Mathieu Ricard. He's the happiest man in the world. And he's very French, you know, he's very sophisticated. He's got a Tibetan monk's robe, but, you know, he's very polished, and he has a shaved head, and his dad was an astrophysicist or something, you know, and he's got a PhD in physics or particle physics, and you know, they wire up his head and they go, look at that, he's so happy, you know. You know. And that's great, you know. But that kind of happiness takes a lot of work. That kind of happiness is not just about your brain waves, it's about the inside and the outside matching up, you know. And that's not always possible to do easily, right? And sometimes it's a work of a lifetime. But I think people are really happy when the outside and the inside match up. And then what they're doing has, like, it's like the, you know, when those two things match up, the problems are not problems in the same way anymore, you know. But to get to that happiness, you kind of sometimes have to admit to yourself sometimes that you're not happy, you know. So I doubt, you know, I think that even Mathieu Ricard, at various moments in his progress on the cushion, probably went into his teacher and said, you know, I'm not happy, you know. And that's how we learn who we really are, you know, by listening to that voice. So sometimes we sit on the cushion and we really do have blissful experiences, and that's wonderful. I'm not saying don't have those. You should be unhappy right now. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, sometimes you sit on the cushion and you realize, you know, I'm not sure, but I'm not sure I like in medical school anymore. And I'm not sure this is what I wanted, you know. And that's like a terrifying thought, right? It can be terrifying. Because after all, you know, mother and dad wanted you to be a doctor. And you became a doctor and you made them so happy, and now you're so worthy of their love, right? And so it's so scary in a certain way to say, but wait, maybe I don't want to be a doctor, you know? And it might not be that you really don't want to be a doctor. It might be something else, you know. It might be that, you know, you're lonely, or that you have another problem, not even related to medical school. It might be related to something else, you know. You're in a relationship that's not a happy relationship, you know. You know, the mind's very clever. So in order to hide, the mind's always trying to protect us, right? It's always trying, the mind is always trying to protect us. And sometimes what it does is it kind of hides the things that it's worried, that will worry us the most, you know? But then they create, you know, that creates like tension. You notice you're tense. And you think, why am I tense, you know? And sometimes the mind has hidden what it doesn't, you know, what it knows will give you a lot of trouble, you know? And so, you know, sometimes Zen practice is like going to the mind, come on, let me see it. Let me see it, you know? No, you don't want to see it. You don't want to see it, you know, because it's going to scare you, you know? No, I can take it, really. I can take it. Show me. Okay. You don't want to be a doctor. Oh, my God! Nobody's going to love me if I'm not a doctor. Right? You know? This is it, you know? So often. And so a lot of Zen practice is sitting with that thing that's so frightening, right? And going, okay, you know, and a lot of the time, you know, we just don't let ourselves do that, you know. So when we encounter the worry, sometimes we just lose ourselves in fantasy, you know. So it's like the fantasy machine starts working, and we start thinking, okay, no, you know, I'm going to be at the top of my class. I'm going to be, you know, have this. I see myself on the golf links. My partner is in the golf cart next to me. You know, somebody's bringing us a nice mint julep on a summer day. You know, and then I'm leaving the country club. I'm driving, you know, here. I go into the hospital. They say, doctor, you're not a moment too, you know, soon. Here, let me help you put on your coat, you know. And you put on your coat, and they say, you're the only man who can solve this problem, you know, and so on. So, you know, and you could spend hours like that, right, you know. And you think, oh, yes, that's safe. Now I'm safe again, right. But then, you know, at some point you get tired of the fantasy, and or maybe the tension. After, it's fantasy or tension, right, fantasy or tension. And at some point, you know, the tension's back, and you stop fantasizing. You realize, okay, well, you know, what are my feelings about this? You know, maybe I don't want to be a doctor. You know, and that's scary. You know, and very hard to accept. You know, especially if you've invested a lot of time, and you and your parents have been highly approving, and you know, but it might not be that at all. It might just be that something's missing from your life. You know, if you don't explore, you never know, right? You know, so koans are kind of helping you to explore. You know, the koan is kind of helping you to dig in there and to see, you know, what's really going on. And it might not be actually that you don't want to be a doctor. It might just be you don't like the kind of medicine you're doing, or it might just be that you need to take up painting classes, you know? That, you know, I mean, basically something like science or business, you know, it's very, 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 very one-dimensional in a certain way, right? I mean, it's, you know, a lot of memorization, a lot of science, you know, a lot of, and there's another element to life that might be missing, you know? I love paintings, you know, because I'll go to a museum and I'll go around the corner and I'll see this painting, and it's just like something I never could have imagined in a million years. And it's slightly like miraculous. It's slightly so cool. You know, it's just, it's like, you know, science is like life as fact in a certain way. You know, science takes imagination too, and creativity too, but especially technical fields can feel very locked in, you know. And you know, if you read a poem, sometimes it can seem so open. You know, it's so exploratory, and it, you know, it's not. Well, poems are really not worried about what's factual. They're just saying, let's imagine the world. You know, let's imagine a world completely differently. You know, where snakes ride bicycles. You know. And that's a poem, you know. It could be entitled "When Snakes Ride Bicycles," and you think, "Oh, what's that about?" You know, and you read it, and all this stuff is in there, and it makes all these new connections. And you don't worry about whether it's true or not, but you know, you might have a big smile on your face. You go outside, and everything seems a little bit more open. You know, you can get that in other ways too. You know, I was thinking this morning I was hitchhiking 30-some years ago in Colorado trying to get to the Vallecito Reservoir to do some hiking. I was standing by the side of the road waiting for a car, and there was a piece of trash about 20 feet away from me. And I looked, and all of a sudden, like a little dust devil caught that piece of trash. It was like a half an envelope or something. And it caught that piece of trash, and I just thought, well, look at that damn thing, you know? And it lifted it up. And I'm not lying. This really happened. And I was just astounded, you know? It caught this piece of trash, and this little dust devil started carrying it up in the air. And it literally carried it out of sight. I'm not lying. This really happened, you know? I thought, that is the damnedest thing, you know? I didn't know that 35 years later I'd tell people and they'd think, that's a lie, you know? But it's not. That really happened, you know? I thought, that is amazing. You know, anything can happen. Anything can happen, right? You know, so, you know, basically, a lot of Zen practice is... is a lot like art in that sense, you know? We get locked in. We get locked in. We think, you know, I must be an endocrinologist, you know? I must be an endocrinologist. And you know, that can create a lot of tension because inside you, there's a voice saying, no, you know? I don't want to be an endocrinologist. And you're going, me? Of course I want to be an endocrinologist, right? You know, and so there's this tension, right? And it can create a huge amount of pressure, you know, this sort of inner conflict, you know, where I know I'm supposed to do this, but my heart is telling me to do something else. And, you know, we usually don't necessarily listen intelligently to the heart because we're too afraid of what it has to say. You know, we might be thinking, what the heart wants me to do is quit medical school and be a beach bum, you know. And it's, well, not necessarily. You know, there's more options than that, you know. You might realize that what's making you unhappy is loneliness in your work, you know. Maybe you shouldn't be doing endocrinology. Maybe you should be doing family medicine, you know. You'll have a practice in a town, you know, basically people will come in to see, you'll see people all day long. You'll see people who need your help. Your personality will matter. You'll come in and go, open, you know, take the tongue depressor, let me see, you know. The kid will be crying and you pull out the lollipop, you know, and it will be wonderful, you know. Maybe that's what you crave, you know. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe working with people's difficult, but you love that, you love the adventure of solitary research, you know. So you have to probe, but usually what keeps us from probing is fear. And fear locks us in because we think, you know, it's either this or it's destruction, you know, or it's ruin. It's either this or it's I'll be unlovable, I can see myself now, you know, I'll be on the street, you know, sleeping on the street, you know, nobody will love me, blah, 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 you know. This is the other alternative, you know. And when you begin to explore, you realize, you know, there's more options than I thought. You know, there's more options. And it's, you know, we just get very locked in, very like tunnel vision. And so Zen, you could think about, Zen is a lot like that experience of my experience on the road where I was, you know, standing there and this wind caught this little piece of paper and carried it up into the sky. You know, who would have guessed, you know? And so, you know, meditation practice has this, this, I think, really astonishing ability to open us up and to help us see alternatives that we didn't think about, you know. And it requires sort of like relaxing the discriminating mind, you know. The discriminating mind is, you know, the mind that's heavily invested in certainties. And yet there's this other creative part of ourselves that I think Zen is really very much committed to, you know. People misunderstand Zen. You know, a lot of people, even in the Zen world, think of Zen as being about like iron discipline. You know, you can go to some Zen temples where it's almost sickening. You know, people are so rigid in their behavior. I really don't think they get it. You know, I don't think they get it. You know, Zen is about spontaneity, like greater spontaneity, and that greater spontaneity comes from learning how to trust the unconscious part of our minds, you know. That's the place where the things we don't want to hear are stored, but also the place where are stored the things we really need to hear, you know. We really need to know about ourselves. You know, we're generally afraid of ourselves. Because we don't listen to that part of ourselves, you know, we're often not very loving to ourselves, not very kind, you know. I'm always amazed by how hard people are on themselves, you know. I meet students all the time who, you know, will come in to see me, and they'll say, you know, I'm an English teacher. I teach writing, and I'll have some student come in to see me, and he'll say, you know, I really need to make an A in this course, and you think, well, what the hell, you know, what am I supposed to do with that, you know. Okay, A it is, you know. All right. Thanks for telling me. I didn't know. And it's possible to go, yeah, sure, of course, you know. And it's possible to go, well, all my students start with A's, you know, but then what happens after that is up to you, you know. I'm always, you know, usually those people are under like terrific pressure, you know. They put huge pressure on themselves, you know. And I often, you know, at the end of every semester, I get students coming to see me about their grades, but very often parents come to see me. And actually it's illegal for me to discuss students' grades in class with their parents, but I have to do it, you know. I have to, you know. So parents will come in to see me, and sometimes the student is there too, you know. But the student never does any of the talking, right? It's all like the parents, and they're trying to cut a deal with me, you know. And I just feel so sorry for those students because they're just under so much pressure, and they're. You know, they're being steered by their parents, and now their parents are even like intervening into the class, and I don't feel contempt for the students at all. I actually feel really sorry for them because, you know, they're under so much pressure, and sometimes the things they've told their parents aren't true. They'll say, you know, but I got straight B's, and they'll come in and say, you know, but he got straight B's, and I'll look and go, well, no, you know, he didn't, you know, and it's like, what? You know, it's like, oh my God, I wish I weren't in those meetings, you know. In other words, you know, the student is under all this pressure, and there's no freedom in the situation at all, you know. And it's very uncomfortable all around and kind of unhappy for everybody. Ideally, you know, people are learning because they want to learn, you know, because it's exciting and so on and so on. And that's often not the motive, though, you know. I myself was in high school, I really wanted to get straight A's because I wanted people to like me, you know. And I wasn't particularly athletic, and I was in some sports, but I didn't get any trophies, you know. And I wasn't particularly attractive. And so, you know, being smart, I thought, was my chance to be likable, you know, be lovable. And I got, you know, really good grades. And when I didn't get good grades, it really bothered me. I, like, really was sort of, like, very critical of myself. And I think what was going on is I just was so worried that nobody would like me if I didn't, if I occasionally got a B, you know. My teacher would just say, you know, I used to like you, but now that you've gotten a B, I just don't. Or my mother would say, I used to love you, my boy, but, you know, now that you're a B student, no. And sometimes parents send that signal, right? You know, you're just not as lovable as you used to be. You know, you're just not as worthy of love, you know. It's these are all difficult things to deal with, and we're especially hard on ourselves, right? I mean, I'm always amazed at how often people are just hugely hard on themselves. You know, very, very judgmental, and very demanding of certain outcome. That says to me that two sides, the two parts don't quite match up yet, you know. It's like, trusting yourself really profoundly, I think, is quite connected to being happy. You know, trusting yourself is quite deeply connected to being happy. And trusting yourself means that you're honest with yourself and with your feelings and your inner life, as we say, you know. And I think Zen is about being sort of digging down in there and seeing what's really there. And it's frightening because, you know, we think it will make us unlovable or monsters, you know. But I don't think it will. I think it will make us more capable. I mean, in the West, the idea is that, you know, if you love others, you'll finally love yourself. That's sort of like a Western idea, you know. But I think the Buddhist idea is, you know, it's difficult to really be loving towards others if you're quite hard on yourself. You know, if you're really sort of like, you know, your jailer, if you're really tough on yourself, you know, I really expect, you know, now Kurt, I really expect the best from you, you know, all the time, 24 hours a day. And if I don't get the best from you, I won't love you, Kurt. And I'm Kurt, you know. So that's a very difficult, then it's very difficult probably for me to like other people either. Especially, by the way, if I don't really like myself very much, I probably don't like people who like me very much, you know? You know what I mean? It's like, well, you know, Groucho Marx used to say, I wouldn't want to be in any country club that would let me in, right? You know? It's like, well, you like me, you're obviously an idiot, you know? Because I'm such an unlikable person, you know? I mean, this is actually, these are like elemental aspects of the human being. A lot of Zen practice is learning how to be aware of who we are, you know, what's going on in there, and being honest about our feelings and our fears. And this is like very healthy. I don't think you can be, you know, I mean, I don't think you can learn to love yourself by trying to love yourself. You know, so for example, I don't think you could sit on the cushion and just go, I love myself, I love myself, I love myself. I don't think that would work. You know, there is a kind of meditation practice, metta meditation, where you send love to other people and you also send love to yourself. And it's very healthy. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I think a deeper practice is is investigating who we really are, you know, and coming to terms with that, you know. And so we're not afraid of what's in there, you know. We're not afraid of what's in there. And as long as we're afraid of what's in there, then, you know, we're always keeping the lid on. We're always sort of like policing ourselves. We're always our own harshest disciplinarian. And that's then I think it's quite difficult to be totally loving and compassionate with other people, because you know there's so much insecurity behind one's actions, you know. And I don't think this is a problem that can ever be totally solved. I think that, you know, people, they just work on themselves in this way, you know, for a long time. And my feeling is that when you meet people like Mathieu Ricard, you know, they're really quite aware of, you know, what's going on in there, and they've learned to live with it. You know, they've learned to be happy and truthful to themselves. And so their actions have a kind of spontaneity, you know. I think this is highly desirable, you know. So when sometimes we do things that we love, and they outside and the inside match, you know. And that's like the ideal thing, right, in Buddhism. That's like the ideal. So, you know, and knowing oneself. No, yesterday I was talking about knowing your fox, you know, your fears and your tendency to be, you know, frightened. You know, I'm sort of making the same point in a little different way today, that we have to listen to these, we have to get to know the self, you know. And the interesting thing is, once you can accept these things, you know, once you encounter your obstacles on the cushion, you know. You're working on a koan and you don't want to face something. And you finally face it, you know. It's not like you become more solid and fixed. It's like you become more fluid and open. And so, you know, we might think that to know yourself is to have absolute certainty finally I see myself now. I see, you know. It's like looking in a mirror and seeing my face. But I think for people who have really gone through this process many times, they look in the mirror and it's an empty mirror. You know, they're very fluid, very adaptable people. I hope this isn't too abstract. Zen is about encountering what we don't necessarily want to see. And when we are really truthful, our actions can have a kind of spontaneity, which is wonderful. You know, and the presence of that spontaneity is a sign that you're really, the two halves are really matching. You know, this is a koan about that spontaneity. You know, if you go on further and turn your body about, no place is left that you are not the master. But even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? You know, so, you know, in life we often have these moments where we just feel, I'm trapped, I don't know what to do, I there's nowhere to turn, right? And this is one of the things that Zen is so great at doing. It lets us realize that, you know, usually we're prisoners of our assumptions, of our presuppositions. And you sit down on the cushion and you begin to study the self, you know, to study the self. You're working with a koan and you begin to realize something about yourself, some fear, something you didn't recognize before, and you finally let it go. And then you realize, my gosh, I've got all these options. There's so many things that I can do with my life. There's so many people I can be. And then life becomes really creative, becomes really not a fear-driven. You know, usually when we're driven by fear, we make bad decisions. Usually fear-driven decisions are bad decisions. I think like security decisions are bad decisions. When we're doing something so that we can be safe. I think better decisions are often more open to possibilities, to the unknown, to playfulness. I think those are better decisions. Experiment, right? Experiment. That's the theme of this sashimi. As Cole Porter said, experiment. Make it your motto day and night. Experiment, and it will lead you to the light. Isn't that koan practice? It's just experiment. See where this goes. Let's see where this goes. And all kinds of wonderful things happen. So let's keep experimenting.